Robin Ayoub again from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode recording. And this particular episode, I think we'll be recording episode 180, if the math gets correct here in my head. I've been recording a few of them today, so it's hard to keep track when you're jumping from one conversation to another, but it's okay. I enjoy doing these types of things. I want to thank all the guests, especially my guest today, Jacqueline Orne, for being part of the conversation, for preparing for this conversation. I know some of these conversations, when you're invited to a podcast, it takes a little bit of preparation. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. This is a typical conversation, like two individuals having coffee. It is not a stressful conversation. I aim for them not to be a stressful conversation. And it's easy, one, for the listeners to continue listening to it. In fact, I heard a couple of listeners telling me that they listen to the podcast at the gym. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. They listen to it at the gym. In my case, I want to listen to some heavy metal in the gym just to keep get me going. Podcast keeps you going at the gym. Please continue listening to our podcast. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Jacqueline, for joining me. I really appreciate it. Welcome to the conversation.
I'm so grateful to be here, Robin. Thank you so much for having me.
So as we get going in our conversation today, Jacqueline, the first question is, what's your story? What got you here?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, I've been on a decade-long journey of self-mastery. That's really taken me to the edges of human consciousness and all the way back to science on multiple different levels. And a few years ago, I left a sales leadership position, realizing that sales wasn't my life's work. And I've been in sales for a long, long time. Most of my life has been in sales. And one of the things that I realized when I left sales was that the way to create exponential change in an organization cannot happen from the middle. It has to happen from the top down. And I'm saying specifically the primary decision maker, the founder. And this ultimately got me to work with a multi-business founder a couple months after that. And I got to see what happened when we actually changed his consciousness and literally led an intervention for him when his team was walking out on him, what actually happened as a result of that intervention. And the results blew my mind, Robin, like so much so that it really changed my way of viewing the way that we develop leaders and the way that we create systemic change. And that actually led me to apply to Minerva University, which is named the most innovative university in the world, to actually study how consciousness was the root of systemic change, and building off of Dr. David Hawkins' work in Power versus Force to basically track the intractable and change the way that we develop leaders from operating in causality to addressing the nonlinear paradigm and metaphysics. And when I actually applied to grad school, I had this crazy experience happen because I got to meet two really important people that changed the trajectory of my path. Number one was Richard E. Boyatzis, who spent the last 60 years studying change from the individual to the dyad, to the team, to the organization, to the community, all the way up to the country and the global processes. And I got a chance to meet Dr. Benjamin Hardy, too, the famous author who's written multiple books with Dan Sullivan and most recently has released his own book called The Science of Scaling. And between the two of them, they both read my thesis, and I got different feedback from both of them. Boyatzis basically was like, you are correct. Consciousness is this in what he calls intentional change theory. And I remember getting that email and being like, wait a second, like this guy just responded. Like, I didn't even know who he was beforehand, but my AI was like, your thesis is really in alignment with this guy. Like, go talk to that guy. And he answered. And that ultimately got me to realize that I actually needed to take a step back and actually learn from someone who's been studying this for the last 60 years. And within a couple of days of that happening, I had a chance to go to Conscious Entrepreneurship Summit here in Boulder. And right beforehand, I like went into meditation. And I was like, who is it that I need to talk to today? Because I just had read Ben's book, Who Not How, his previous year. And I realized it was actually Dr. Benjamin Hardy himself that I needed to talk to. So within about 30 minutes of getting to the conference, I had a chance to be able to go talk to him, to be able to go tell him he was my super who, basically, use his own language back on him. And then he asked me why I thought that way. And I quickly helped explain why it was that I thought he was my super who. Long story short, he read my thesis, told me he'd do anything he needed to do to get behind me, and told me to not read any of his other books besides The Science of Scaling, which, you know, in my own life journey, when someone says that, it's important, right? Especially with someone who has a reputation and level of respect that he's earned. So basically, I went home and I gave The Science of Scaling to my partner because I felt like she wasn't dreaming big enough. And within days of giving her the book, she literally ran me through the process that Ben has in his book. And I realized that I didn't need to go to grad school, actually. And it took me about 3 days to feel my feelings about going through the whole process of getting into grad school and then needing to say no. Because ultimately, I realized that the way that we actually create cultural change, the way we actually create systemic change, all the way down from consciousness to how the change happens to how to scale it exponentially, all that research has already been done, but no one's actually integrated it into one system. So I decided to defer grad school and then integrate the three sciences into what is now the cultural catalyst system, which makes up the underlying infrastructure for our network.
Cultural catalyst system. You know, when my first surprise was when I interviewed, Carter earlier. And when she said to me, belonging is a science. There is a science behind the, you know, you mentioned earlier, you just joined a company and people were leaving and, you know, you can't make people stay. It's something that every enterprise struggle with to a certain level. And when I was surprised that there is actually research on that, that whole cultural of belonging. And now you give me another science around scaling, because everybody talks about scaling. The science of scaling, right? So everybody talks about it, but you have to scale. You know, you got to get funding, you got to get marketing, you got to get all the pieces in place to scale. But, you know, nobody really taking a look at it from a scientific perspective. What are the foundational aspects to scale? Could you talk a little bit about some of the principles, I guess, in the science behind scaling?
Yeah, and I want to affirm what you're saying, Robin, on this, is that everyone's talking about scaling and no one's been having an empirical science of how it actually occurs until now. And so that's what Dr. Benjamin Hardy actually realized, is that there's all this misinformation going on and not one consolidated system that can create repeatable results over and over again. So what Ben actually did was he studied scaling science and he created his own framework that's broken down into three things. What's your frame? What's your floor and what's your focus? And one of the things is like, it's like a triple F, right? If anyone takes away anything, what is the scaling science? It's three Fs, frame, floor, focus. But what makes it so unique about what it is that scales something exponentially instead of incrementally? And I'll give you an example. So I was having a conversation with an eight-figure founder about her scaling and actually using the 10X frame within 3 years. And she said she was already scaling to me. And I was like, okay, so I need to be more specific. When I say scaling, from the scaling science perspective, it actually means X within 3 years or less, because people could be scaling 3X, right? And they can view themselves as scaling, but that's not what Hardy's teaching here. He's talking exponential growth from the frame of X within three years or less. And the reason why is because you're purposely meant to create an impossible goal with an impossible frame to redefine who you are and simplify your system to scale. And when you redefine who you are, and it allows for you to basically see what's below the floor, which is basically your current level of standards, the things, the relationships, the contracts, the people, the businesses, the services that you're providing, it basically illuminates what's below the floor. And that's the second F, right? And then the third F is focus. So once you actually redefine who you are and simplify your focus, what it does is it illuminates a path. And oftentimes when we set a goal that, you know, we believe in, but we're not so sure that we can actually complete it, this is really important for people who've already achieved what they've set out to achieve. Because what happens when you set a goal that's so big that it might seem impossible and that you might not be able to hit it within a certain time frame, what happens is it allows for you to change your thinking and for you to be able to see pathways that you wouldn't be able to see there. Because the biggest challenge that, you know, Ben talks about is that when people are scaling, you cannot scale a complex system and you have to make the one thing the one thing. So for founders who are making even something the two thing, the three thing, the four thing, the five thing, we can't do that when we scale exponentially. It literally has to be one thing. And the biggest hindrance to this system is people being dishonest with themselves. And one of the things that intentional change theory talks about, which is Boyatzi's 60 years of intentional change theory, is that the biggest challenge of the mind is the blind spots. So when we want to achieve something that seems completely impossible and do it in a timeline that makes redefine who we are and what we do with our time, we might not know which path to choose. And that's part of being in that uncertainty of letting the path be illuminated, which a lot of people don't have the capacity to be able to sit in that unknown, especially high performance people who are used to knowing everything. So it is definitely a growth system as much as it is a spiritual process, because ultimately one has to let go of themselves and what it is that got them here, the infrastructures that they've built, the businesses that they've built, the impact that they already have to do this and find a very simple pathway that can really only lead to that ideal.
Jacqueline, do you have any data on or statistics on the system that you just described and the success ratio for the people who adopted it? Is it like, I'm just trying to figure out, and probably the audience are saying, well, it only probably worked for the 1%. Does it really?
Yeah.
Is that the case?
There's not specific statistics as terms of what is the success rate of it. But one of the things Dr. Benjamin Hardy does talk about is that even though the system is really simple, it doesn't mean it's easy. And so one of the things that, you know, intentional change theory tells us, which is how does change happen, right? How does sustained change happen, let alone how does desirable change happen? And it's something called PEA, positive emotional attractor, neurological and physiological state that actually sustains your change efforts. So setting the right goal in the scaling science is just as important as just running through the system itself, because with the inevitable challenges of having to let go of things, which basically puts you into a place of fight or flight, makes you go into worry, makes you go into your focused mindset, it's important to have a vision that's great enough that actually will pull you. So no matter how hard it gets, you're still able to overcome the inevitable challenges of, you know, doing the impossible, basically.
Now, when people are you know, in that frame of mind and they're trying to scale up, I know like some industries, specifically like, you know, our channel is called, my channel is called Localization Industry, Fireside Chat, meaning that that language industry, all of it, it is, with some exception, of course, I'm generalizing for the effect here, but with some exceptions, are don't like change. So change is a fundamental thing in terms of growing. So if you want to grow, if you want to scale up, and, you know, a lot of people define, and I love how you defined hyperscaling in terms of 10x versus, you know, I grew 10% this year. Well, yeah, the GDP probably is 10%. I don't know. Inflation probably 10%. I have no idea. If you're not growing beyond what the normal growth is, that's not growth. That's flat. But you mentioned all these things needs to happen in a constant change mode.
Yeah.
People, structure, policies, all the stuff that needs to take place. From your experience, and I know you advise companies, you're an entrepreneur, you talk about the topic, you probably advise your customers on the topic. What is your advice for that?
Well, it's interesting, you know, if that conversation I was just talking to you about, that eight-figure founder who's like, I'm already scaling. And I was like, no, you're not 10xing in 3 years. So you either need to commit to 10xing in 3 years or less, or not commit to 10x in 3 years or less. So I'm just going to back up on that conversation, because we actually had a much longer conversation that evening, which basically opened up with her asking me how to make a specific decision. She was looking to buy some real estate, and she sat down and she asked me that question. And so I brought the frame. I took the frame. Okay. So I was like, if we were to 10x within the next 3 years or less, what would fall below your floor? And she was like, oh, that would mean I would need to sell one of my businesses, for example. Right. And then once we actually went into what that would mean for her, there was a part of her that didn't want to do that, because what she's built, which is an eight-figure business, right? She's gone from bankrupt within to $13 million in revenue over 10 years, right? She's built the thing. She's gone from one place to another. She didn't want to let go of it because she really enjoys where she is right now. And she's earned it, quite frankly. And there's a part of her that's enjoying.
That's typical, right? Isn't it? You know, that's a comfort zone, right?
Totally.
So it's the space.
Yeah. So there's a part of her that's enjoying coasting to some extent. But when we actually went a little bit deeper into that, what we actually found on the other side of this was actually some level of boredom, like that she's gotten so good at what she's doing right now that there's a part of her that's bored. And there was a concern that came up in that conversation of, you know, entropy, like if she's not growing, she's dying, right? And that's a perfect example of, you know, when it comes to someone who's already successful, what Ben would call that is, you know, the scaling science is to be able to distinguish the signal from the noise, to be able to use the frame in regards to making decisions, to be able to discern what decisions to make, and then to be able to take action on it. And, you know, a perfect example of what happened in that conversation with her was the frame of 10xing in 3 years wasn't enough to her. She had it too good and she had earned it, right? But what we actually got to see was what she actually wanted, the thing that actually turned her on, the thing that was actually pulling her instead of pushing her, had nothing to do with her business, actually. It was a personal aspiration that would affect her ability to actually acquire the thing that she wanted. So that changed the reason why we were doing the frame. Using the 10x within 3 years frame suddenly became connected to her personal aspirations. Instead of having to make her step out of something uncomfortable, there was an intrinsic desire. There was a pull to 10x within 3 years instead of a push to 10x within 3 years. And when we go down into like the science of consciousness, right? And the scaling, and when what does the science of consciousness tell us about, you know, intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation versus push versus pull, right? Well, for us to be pulled forward in something, it has to be from power. It has to be greater than ourselves. So I think where people get lost in using the scaling science or going from 8 figures to 9 figures, I was watching another founder talk about this the other day. He's already hit 8 figures and now he's all obsessed with making 9, is that his reasoning for doing it is in the wrong place. It has to be greater than yourself. It has to pull you. It has to come from power to be able to make that change process sustainable. Otherwise, you're going to burn out and or have to grind through. And the people I work with are not wanting to grind anymore. They've enjoyed the success that they've built. They enjoy the ease that they built. And they do want to expand their impact, but they don't want to do so from grind. They want to do so from pleasure and ease.
No, personally, you experienced a lot of change in your career. I mean, for the audience, Jacqueline, you told me you're in sales and you left sales. Yeah. And you started, you know, how did you manage change personally on a personal level?
Like, well, my journey actually...
Did you get bored with sales? Like, what happened with sales? I mean, I come from a sales background. I'm still in sales.
Yeah. And that's true. I mean, I've been in sales since I was 16. And so for me, once I learned how to sell and how to help people, you don't turn the sales skill off. And I do agree with that. For me, my story actually started much earlier than that. When I was 25, I had a dream job doing exactly what I wanted to make a lot of money in the place I wanted to do it. And I got fired out of nowhere, basically. And that had me basically take a step back and be like, who am I? Like, what do I want? It's not that, but like, who am I? And this ultimately led me to a journey of fasting on water for 36 days, actually.
What? Really?
Yes.
36 days on water?
36 days on water.
You survived, obviously, but how did you feel?
I found out that love is not personal, actually. That love is something that flows through us that we all have access to. That time is limited by the mind, and all that there really is timelessness and peace. Quite frankly, it completely changed my perception of reality. And for the last decade, I've had to take the time to basically integrate what happened in that experience and then take it back into the world. And so I've been in sales since I was 16, and I've been in sales in and out for years and years and years. And the way that I've developed salespeople has changed too, because a lot of the ways that people develop salespeople is addressing things from the conscious mind, when 80% of it's the subconscious mind, right? And so from that experience, I've had to become someone that I never imagined myself to be. The person that's standing here in this conversation with you, my mother says, I never imagined the life that you have for yourself right now. And that's because who I was and what my life was about and what I was fundamentally interested in completely changed after that experience. And for me, the way to actually go through that experience and then come back into the world has been to dedicate my life to something higher. Everything. That's how I've been able to come out of that and to integrate that experience and overcome the immense amount of challenges and the long-term, it wasn't just immense challenge, it was long-term challenge, and actually come out of that experience a better person and more capable and more competent and more connected to something that's greater than myself.
Now, you referred to something called identity level transformation.
Yes.
Is this what you mean?
No. So that specific instance, I mean, identity level transformation is based off of intentional change theory. The first step of intentional change theory, it's that 60 years of research from Boyatzis, is what is that part, what is the ideal self that you have for yourself? Who do you want to become? Who do you want to be in the future, right? And that actually is what creates the gap between who you are right now and who you want to be. And that creates pull motivation versus push motivation. Because a lot of us, the challenge is we have all this conditioning. It's called the ought self, who we should be, the expectations from others, the cultural programming on who we should be and how we should live our lives. And that experience blew all that out the water. Like there was no going back, because I got to see reality from a perspective that most people don't get to see. And so that's why consciousness, the science of consciousness, is the foundation to the cultural catalyst system, because consciousness is actually the mechanism that underlies impact. Just like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Winston Churchill, for example, like why did those people overcome, like Winston Churchill, for example, like Hitler had a better army, like he had better everything. So why did Winston Churchill overcome them, right? And it's actually because his consciousness was calibrated more towards love and valor, and the consciousness of Hitler was like basically associated with force and life-taking. So that's why the cultural catalyst system is such an integrated system. It's like I am integrating science on all these different levels right now. And the biggest thing that I got to see in my own coaching and consulting process is that the way that people think change happens is very limited by the mind. And once you can bypass the mind, you can access exponential outcomes. That's what the mind, it's like, that's where we access imagination, right? imagination, it's creativity, it's beyond what got us here. And Einstein even said, what got us here won't get us there. So we literally have to change the way we think, who we are, and create a vision so strong for ourselves that it pulls us instead of us having to push for it.
Now, I'm sure you've observed this before with other founders or other executives you're dealing with. How much do you think what I call midlife recalibration becomes a problem in the system or the systems that we design in the future?
Totally. Well, the systems that we design are inherently out of the way that we view reality and what we've been conditioned and to be programmed with that have been passed down for thousands of years. So when we look at like what's going on right now, whatever side you're on, we can all kind of agree that everything's in the process of being updated, whether we like it or not.
You're right.
And so when it comes to actually, you know, redesigning new and existing structures, it starts with actually setting a vision for who you want to be as, in our case, a cultural catalyst. A cultural catalyst is the ideal identity for some people who are wanting to create a new culture. And that identity is actually what creates that pull motivation for a sustainable and desirable change process to occur. But what happens once you actually connect to who you are, and then you set a scaling goal from the lens of contribution, something that's greater than yourself on top of it, it illuminates everything that's below your floor. The programs, the conditions, the people, the structures, everything that's around you that's not going to help you get to where you want to go. And that's actually where we have to let go. We have to learn how to let go, which letting go is a mechanism as taught in spiritual traditions to actually be able to spiritually develop. And so for us to actually create a new culture, we literally need to become new people and expand our leadership capacity.
Sounds like a religious conversation.
You could say it's religious, but for me, my body of work comes from the lens of, it's not this or that. So, you know, in religion, it can often put things from a lens of what's right.
But I mean, in every aspect of our life, Jacqueline, we have to let go of the old to capture something new. It doesn't matter if you have an old car, you got to get a new car, you got to get rid of the old car. I mean, it's just even on a on a possession level, that's the case anyway. Imagine that at an identity level, that's even worse. Now, for those out there who's listening to this podcast and they're saying, you know what, I'm happy, things are well, like, what am I listening to here? If somebody's listening to us and says, okay, what are the observable signals that a leader is stuck, but we don't know that they're stuck, and they have an outdated identity, they probably need to update.
Yeah, well, you know,
what are these? Some of
the first things? Thing to notice if we are happy or something along those lines, it's funny. I got this question a couple weeks ago on a different podcast. It's like, how about the people who've already achieved, they've done all the things right? They've achieved what they set out to achieve and they have everything they have, right? And if you're happy, that's great. But most people don't realize that they're not happy. Let's just start there. Most people have no idea that they're not happy because they are so busy doing all the things all the time that they're not left alone long enough to know that they're not happy. And so that's where the practice of mindfulness comes in. And when people talk about mindfulness to reduce stress levels, mindfulness is a foundational level skill to even know what's happening in the present moment. And if we're so busy that we're not even aware of what it is that our body's feeling in this moment in time, you know, we're going to be missing part of our experience of being alive, for example, being able to feel what it is we're feeling in our body, to be able to notice the thoughts that are there that are present, to notice how our engagements and our everything are going. But, you know, one of the things that intentional change theory talks about is that we need a tipping point. We need a tipping point to be able to change from one aspect to another. And sometimes...
Or a catalyst of some sort, right?
Yeah, it's called a tipping point. Right. And it's either externally caused, which, you know, one of the things I say, you're welcome to not change. You can never change. And, you know, life might throw you a 2x4, you know, that stuff happens to people. And often they go through some type of awakening afterwards and then they change. And then, but the internal desire to change, you're saying people who are happy, those aren't primarily the people. I mean, we already are working with people who are happy. So for cultural catalyst is an ideal identity. It's an outcome for people who are wanting to make something greater of their lives than creating something for themselves. And doing so is actually what creates the purpose and meaning in one's life. And it so happens that we're at a really interesting time in our culture. I would say we're at a tipping point in our culture here, that we can either be part of the positive tipping point right now, or we can be part of the negative tipping point. And that's up to everyone's volition. Some people are going to listen to this and they're like, I have no desire to participate as a tipping point. And other people are like, I'm a cultural catalyst. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, there's always two categories of when it comes to these types of things. There's people who are completely happy. They don't want to change. Their life is perfect according to where they are, where their life scenario is. And some people that they're, I call them like a little fidgety in their life, right? So they're never happy. Yeah. They're never satisfied. They're always looking for that next best big thing that they want to do in their lives. And they want to achieve bigger goals all the time. In fact, when I lived in the East Coast of Canada, there were towns where like, I don't know, a few thousand people, towns, fishing villages around the coast. And, you know, they deliver services in a large geography to those towns is very challenging. So there was some discussions around, you know, offering these individuals to move to a larger centers or perhaps, you know, putting jobs in a adjacent center, but they have to travel to them. Nope, I don't want to do that. I want to fish lobsters. I want to chop wood and I want to be a lumberjack, whatever. Life is happy for them. And that's how they determine life. But some other people, like I'm a, you know, CEO of a bank. I want to be a CEO of a bigger bank. I want to get a different job altogether. Now, we talked about this one as well in terms of measuring culture. Culture is a measurable thing. In your opinion, Jacqueline, what KPIs move when leadership identity evolves or changes?
Yeah, so one of the things of the principles of intentional change theory, how change happens in a sustainable and desirable way, all the way across the fractal, which is from the individual to the dyad, to the team, to the organization, to the community, to the country, to the global process, is something called resonant relationships. So when you actually look at what the theory says, is how does change happen across all these different parts of the system? And there's two things that it primarily comes down to. Number one is a social identity group in which you have a collective shared vision, values, and purpose. And in our case, ours is Cultural Catalyst. That's our social identity group for people who are like hearing this and they're like, I didn't hear that until now, but that's totally me. Yeah, that's been designed that way so that people can either identify in or identify out. And then the second thing that's actually required is something called resonant relationships. And a lot of people around me call it coherence, but that's actually not the correct word. Resonance is made up of three things: shared vision, shared compassion, and shared energy. And what's really interesting about shared compassion, because one of the things I was seeing with my high-level clients in setting these big goals with them that pull them forward, right, that give meaning and purpose to their life, expand their impact, and so far, they need peers. They were like surrounded by employees and contractors and, you know, basically the people that got them here won't get them to their next iteration. One of the things that the science actually tells us is that they actually need peers at their level of competence, which is a fancy word for basically says that has capacities. Founders who've built similar things, they're going to have similar skill sets basically, and they're easily going to be able to have compassion for each other. And what's really interesting about what the science actually tells us is their peer relationships, the relationship between different leaders, either create something called PEA or NEA. And PEA stands for positive emotional attractor and NEA stands for negative emotional attractor. And that's the physiological and neurological state that actually sustains change or actually halts change in the process. So what the science is actually changing, telling us on how change happens is that you actually need the right peer relationships to have that shared vision, to have that shared competence and compassion, and to activate each other in what's called emotional and social contagion that actually fuels the change process. So what I'm trying to say is like your peers, and not necessarily the ones that got you here, but the ones that are serving and in alignment with the who it is that you want to be, they act as like the fuel, like you're going to a gas tank, like gas station, for example, and having the right peers around you is literally what is fueling your tank to be able to go and forward in the sustained and desired change process. So that's actually how the science works. And one of the things that Richard actually talks about is when it comes to cultural level change, because cultural level change, it requires more data over longer periods of time and more capital to be able to actually track these longer studies. There's less information about how cultural change actually happens. And one of the things that we're hoping to do with the Cultural Catalyst Network is to actually get that data to be able to see and track these cultural catalysts over time and the impact that they make in their subcultures and their cultures to actually, you know, create the science. Quite frankly, the science is already there, but to create even more case studies of how cultural change actually happens and the actual measurables behind that.
You know, one of the things is like we keep talking about when it comes to change, either it comes from within, you want to change, or it's forced upon you, right? And if it's forced upon you, then you go through the change. I'm guessing the way you go through that change is not a comfortable change. But if it comes from within, it's on purpose, it's determined, and then you end up with a lot better success and a high level of satisfaction anyway. So in your opinion, how do you distinguish psychological safety from the comfort of culture or culture of comfort?
Got it. Yeah. Well, you know, your question about psychological safety, how do you distinguish psychological safety from a culture of comfort? Well, I would indicate that would be something to do with the actual nervous system's capacity, for example. And so when it comes to creating a bigger impact and to be able to, one of the things that's actually required to be able to scale exponentially and not incrementally, and also for the change process to actually occur and be sustained, is what intentional change theory calls practicing new feelings, thoughts, behaviors, and habits, right? And when you look at what the scaling science says about that, it says expand your leadership capacity, which is you're going to need to create new thoughts, feelings, habits, exactly the same. And the research primarily has been focused on like cognitive behavioral therapy as being the primary way to create that change. Mm. However, one of the things that I've learned over the last decade of, you know, going from fasting on water for 36 days, having a spiritual crisis, taking 10 years to integrate it and come back into the world with a level of groundedness and clarity and ultimate truth, is that there's a technique called emotional freedom technique. It stands for EFT, also known as tapping. It's a clinically researched technique that is used primarily for PTSD or complex PTSD recovery. It has similar effectiveness in terms of EMDR, which is like the gold standard when it comes to trauma release. And in my own journey of taking what happened and basically experiencing unconditional love for weeks on end, and then getting to experience the opposite of that for many years until I could stabilize that within myself, was I learned techniques to be able to let go of the negativity and the previous belief systems and the old patterns and the generational stuff that's been passed down and the cultural conditioning, all that stuff had to be able to be let go, basically. I learned two techniques in being able to do that. I learned EFT, and I also learned the mechanism of surrender as taught by Dr. David Hawkins. And so one of the things that we're doing in the Cultural Catalyst Network is actually integrating EFT and the mechanism of surrender in for these founders so that they can expand their leadership capacity and not just let go of what's below their floor from an intellectual standpoint. You have to understand, when you're asking people to let go of relationships and previous systems and businesses, this is emotional work, okay? And that's actually nervous system capacity. And one of the things that when we look at when it comes to nervous system capacity is that a lot of us are running on a 3G network, okay? Our full capacity is 5G, but most of us are running on a 3G network. Okay. And what does that mean? Most of us are like, our nervous system basically can use a flip phone. Okay. And that affects our ability to lead. That affects our ability to make decisions. That affects our ability to have relationships with others that actually be able to consistently produce results, let alone exponential results for people. And so to be able to expand your impact and expand your capacity and really actualize your desire, in our case, to be a cultural catalyst or whatever it is for you, you have to turn on 5G. And the only way that you can turn on 5G within your nervous system is to let go of the negativity that is distorting the signal within your body so that you can lead from a place of clarity, from a place of mindfulness, from a place of attunement, from a place of response instead of reaction. We're living in a world right now that's moving faster than faster than faster. And my biggest concern right now, and most of us are still running on 3G, and we're just turning on the gas even more with AI. And so there's even more complexity to be able to address. And so that's why our ability to be able to be calm, to be able to be resourced, to be able to have the capacity to be able to meet every single moment that is in this moment with us is of the greatest challenge. And quite frankly, that's why we're offering that to people, because we know that they're not going to actualize themselves without doing that work.
Based on the conversation I've been having on this channel, and you bring up a very valid point around, you know, we're running on a slow level versus high level energy that you're indicating, and you're using the example rightly, the 3G versus 5G. You know, humanity currently, and my previous guest and I were just talking about the same topic, is that by design, from the products we consume, the technology we use, everything that we touch is designed to make us less productive. It's designed, maybe we asked for it, I have no idea. Maybe humanity asked for that convenience. I press a button, things happen. I don't have to get up and turn the TV. And I saw this cartoon the other day, a caricature where the TV was so thick in the back and the individual watching the TV was so thin. And as the TV thinned out, the individual got fatter. So we're not necessarily engaging with anything anymore. And now we've got some other technology. I was just having a conversation about that one. Is it glasses now with technology built into the glasses that we can just move our eyes? We don't even have to use our fingers anymore. Is it by design that we're at a 3G level, and God help us if we go down further to 1G?
when we address like whether things are right or wrong, right? When we look at like what's happening and we're like, was this on purpose? Like, this doesn't seem like a good idea. I don't know if this is going to be good for everybody down the own. Why is it that we're engaging with this way? Well, you have to understand that the systems that are being designed are being affected by the level of awareness, the consciousness, the attractor field of the person. So you have, you know, Claude.ai that's programmed to be honest, ethical, and kind, right? And then you have chat that is not programmed to be honest, ethical, and kind, right? That is literally a different consciousness that's being put into a system. And so when it comes to really redesigning the new, like the structures of our culture right now, that's why it's so important that we make sure that what we're designing and where we are is actually from a place of it being life-giving and life-taking. So I don't believe personally that these humans are at fault. I believe that everyone is inherently innocent. It's that, you know, there's aspects of consciousness that are running through them that may accidentally be creating what are called negative externalities or negative consequences per se. And that's the world we live in right now, is that there is a lot of negative consequences to how Facebook built its platform, because it's not optimized for connection. It's optimized for ad revenue, right? And so does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. No, thank you. Appreciate it. You mentioned in earlier, I guess you talked a little bit about it, but I also read about it, about you. You referenced Hardy's science of scaling. I'm just trying to understand, your perspective, what advice people are getting today, not from you, for somebody else, that you think is wrong?
Oh my goodness.
Do we need to correct? Because a lot of people out there advising about scaling, right? So anybody who's somebody, you know, he's a scale advisor.
I'm just going to actually use the Hormozi and the Tony Robbins interview as a specific example. I don't know if you had the chance to watch that, but that thing went viral on my social media because I'm an entrepreneur. So I watched that and I got to see the science of change, power versus force, like the consciousness science. And I got to see scaling science in one conversation. And basically we got to see how Hormozi was setting goals from a place of having a belief system that happiness is impossible. Basically, it's my duty to suffer. And he had no idea how to be able to create an impact from a way that actually made him fulfilled along the way. So it's all discovered in the interview, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Tony talked about is like the things that you tell yourself are the things that you're going to experience. So he created a system, even though he created a very scalable system, that didn't make him happy. That actually made him empty at the end. So much he was writing checks to charities and feeling nothing, right? And one of the things that Tony pointed out was that he was in what was called analytical Alex, which was he was in his head, basically. And analytical Alex was not very happy. And he was like pretty neutral and, you know, very analytical. And one of the things that Tony started to do was connect him to something that actually gave him energy. So in his case, he connected Hormozi to a previous experience in which he felt joy. He felt the moment he had $100,000 in his bank account, he felt him and his wife literally actually could mess up for years and still be okay, right? That was a very fulfilling experience for Alex. You literally, if you watch the interview, if you haven't watched the interview yet, you literally see Tony run him through the scaling science, okay? He's like, okay, so, you know, for people who've already achieved what they set out to achieve, that's when we set a moonshot goal, which is another word for an impossible goal, right? We're going to set, and Google uses these terms to describe things that, you know, we don't know if we're going to work, but we're going to go for it anyways. That's the kind of thing. So what Tony had him do was set an impossible goal, and then he started literally decreasing the timeline on him. But one of the things that Tony did that I want to make sure people hear when they come to the scaling science is Tony had him set a contribution goal, something that he would give, not get, okay? A lot of the people, when I see using the scaling science, that other eight-figure founder that I was talking about, he's like, what would it take for me to go to 8 to 9 figures? And he dropped $250,000 on Hormozi to tell him how to do it. Why is it that you need to go to 9 figures? What is the purpose of your business? And so if there is not a purpose to your business that's greater than yourself, you are accidentally creating something that will not give you fuel. You're accidentally creating something that will not fill you up emotionally, and you're accidentally creating something that's going to deplete you and not nourish you. And so that's why we want to make sure we use the scaling science in a way that it's greater than ourselves, that it's going to pull us forward. And when I talked about higher purpose earlier in this podcast, because I was like, I learned to dedicate myself to from something higher to be able to recover from a 36-day water fast and come to the world. Why is that, right? That's not something random. When you actually look at AA, for example, and what is it that has been having AA recover people for decades now, is one of the principles of AA is you need to surrender your will over to God, okay? And I had no idea what that meant the first time I read it. Here's to know what that meant specifically. But one of the things that I knew and had to experience over and over and getting out of basically a spiritual crisis that was on the other side of the 36-day water fast was to dedicate myself to something higher over and over again. Because you have to understand, when you are only doing something for yourself, when things get hard, you're not going to keep going. That's why people in the first step of AA say, I am completely powerless to the substance. Okay. If they are going to overcome substance abuse, they're not going to do it. Their ego is the thing that's causing the substance abuse. So as long as they're doing it themselves, they're not overcome the inherent challenges of overcoming substance abuse. So the same thing is true for when we set our goals. We have to set things that are greater than ourselves. And we know because it fuels us. You hear me talking about it. I'm very energized, right? And that's how, when you set the correct goal, it's supposed to feel. And we got to see Tony do that at the end of the thing, because Alex went from analytical Alex to anabolic Alex, which he was smiling. He was happy. And that goal is literally became of someone who he wants to be. So he went from not having any idea of how happiness would happen to actually setting a goal so big and creating a timeline that it actually made him happy, so that the destination is just as enjoyable as the outcome.
Now, in culture, the Culture Catalyst network model, let's talk a little bit about this. Oh, you can't hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Testing. How about that? Everything is good on my side. My equipment's still going. My microphone's still going. Did I touch something here? No. How's that? Better? I can hear you. Can you hear me? You can't hear me? That's weird. The voice is recorded. I'm hearing you. I don't know. Where is it coming from? I don't see anything. I can hear you very well.
Yeah,
my voice is being received. You can't hear me at all?
Can you hear me? The thing.
Just let me see. Just a chat. Let me see here. Can you hear me? Okay. No, you can't hear me. Okay. Why is that? How's that?
Will you talk now? Oh, there we go.
Better?
Hold on.
Testing.
There we go. We're good.
Testing.
I think it was my passion.
Testing.
My passion just totally stopped.
We're good. We're back to normal. Yeah. Don't worry. We'll edit that. We'll edit this one, but I'll keep your smile. You have a beautiful smile. So we'll keep that one. The rest we'll edit out. Don't worry. I was just talking about, can you hear me okay now? You good? Okay, cool. So the Culture Catalyst network model, peer network instead of one-on-one coaching?
We know one-on-one coaching works. And the reason why one-on-one coaching is great is because one-on-one coaching does help you actually see your blind spots. And one of the things that, you know, intentional change theory talks about is the way we actually sustain our desired change process is to be able to be reflected back our blind spots from PEA, like what we talked about earlier. And so one of the things that we actually wanted to do was make sure that we created an environment for peers to actually be able to give themselves feedback from their ideal self in mind, which in our case is being a cultural catalyst. And what that does is it creates the neurological and physiological state for one, the feedback to be received, and two, for the change process to actually occur. And so when we actually look at who the Cultural Catalyst Network was made for, was that they were needing peers. They weren't needing more coaching. They weren't needing more strategy. They were actually just needing peers who share their vision of being a cultural catalyst, have a similar level of competence, and can activate each other. So what we're actually doing in the network is creating an infrastructure for them to be able to expand their leadership capacity, let go of what's underneath their floor, and actually create resonance within the forums themselves, so that these founders can problem solve, so they can resource share, so they can be creative, so they can give each other feedback. Because you also have to understand, YPO has been around for 50 plus years at this point. And what often starts with what the research says is they go in for problem solving and resource sharing. What happens is it actually turns into a culture of belonging. And that's what we're hoping to do within the Cultural Catalyst Network, is to create a culture of belonging so that we can fuel each other, basically, to help each other see what we can't see, and to be able to actualize our desires to create a new culture, but not alone, but together. And the science says that it needs to be together, not alone.
Yeah. Is there an overlap between what you just described and executive masterminds?
Yeah, so it's funny. Ideating on the creation of what is now the Cultural Catalyst Network, one of the things that we found was that there was primarily business masterminds, and then there was spiritual development stuff. And for the people that we work with who identify as cultural catalysts, business masterminds don't really get all of them. They miss the part of them that's into personal development, and they definitely don't cover the part of them that wants to create a new culture. And then the spiritual development groups, they're not able to talk business whatsoever. And so they're not being able to be fully met in that. And so what we're creating right now literally hasn't existed until now. It is specifically made for people who identify as cultural catalysts, who want to make a greater greater impact that's greater than themselves, that will actually change the culture after they leave this planet. So that's why, to answer your question, it hasn't existed until now.
That's going to take me directly to my next question. Your network revenue funds a regenerative land trust project. Why integrate ecological restoration into leadership program or leadership development?
Yeah, well, this is
that
actually
part of the plan that you talked about earlier?
My co-founder. What her purpose on this planet is to regenerate nature specifically. And the only way that we can regenerate nature is to actually be able to have the funds to even regenerate nature. And so the point of the Cultural Catalyst Network is, yes, we're going to create a new culture. We're going to create exponential cultural change. We're going to have fun doing it. We're not going to burn out because we're doing it together. And we get to actually enjoy the process. And then underneath that, that money actually goes to what, you know, when I talked about what is the higher purpose of the business, that is the higher purpose of our business. The money from this isn't just about our acquiring. It's actually about what is the contribution that we leave here. And for my business partner, that is the most important part of, you know, the business is making sure we allocate and actually start regenerating nature through it.
So it's more like of a moral alignment.
Well, it's interesting, you know, it's funny. We're in an age right now where people are, you know, putting their money from the place of social activism in a way that creates ROI, right? And at the same time, you know, that's coming in it from the lens of what do I get out of it immediately? And when we do things from that, we're inherently in the selfish mind. We're forgetting that we're interconnected with everything. And then we feel like there's no purpose, right? So when it comes to living a life full of meaning and purpose, and when it comes to having a higher purpose, it does need to be outside of ourself. And in that specific instance, is like our moral obligation is what is the foundation of the bedrock. And of course, that affects the strategy, but it's not the other way around.
Is there a business case for ecological integration here, or just more of it? Yeah. No, I know, but I mean, people are listening, probably they're thinking, you know what? Yeah, I can contribute to a couple of programs. I do tax. I get some tax benefit out of my contributions, and you know, I'm good. My conscience clear now. I'm assuming you're advocating for
and
more
than just, I'm
talking
from a higher level of awareness than that.
Tax benefit stuff.
Because, you know, when we're in a paradigm of this versus me, you said, what is the one thing that most people get stuck in? You know, and I addressed the scaling science and accidentally using the scaling science for our own purposes versus then something greater than ourselves. There's something actually lower than that in regards to how the mind functions in a way that it creates judgment and it perceives reality as a this versus that. That's what they mean as duality, that we see things as this versus that. And when we get caught in this perspective of only being caught in the here, that we lose access to the higher domain of synchronicities, miracles, magic, literally. How do things happen that are random, right? This isn't random. This is from a psychologist ages ago. I think it was Carl Jung who's talking about synchronicities. So like this has been studied and that type of stuff. So, you know, that those are the domains of love and joy and gratitude. So when people are only investing from a place of what I get it from me or from a place of logic and reason, which is, of course, this makes logic and reasonable sense to be able to contribute to themselves. They're actually limiting themselves to being able to receive the higher aspects of human nature, which are love, gratitude, and joy.
Correct. So what you're saying is not a direct benefit to your financials, it's a direct benefit to the person who you are. By enjoying what you're doing, your contribution will enhance you emotionally, morally, et cetera. And that's going to be a quite down the road kind of a, you know, I don't know how long you've been in this business, but what is your future outlook for, you know, leadership? Like if you look down the road 10 years from now, what do you think the defining?
I think for me, you know, when I look down the road 10 or so years right now, I'm looking at like what the Cultural Catalyst Network does and pulling together cultural catalysts to actually activate each other to create exponential cultural change and to be able to expand their capacity. And so what I'm seeing is that there are going to be leaders who are going to be operating from a new paradigm that hasn't existed until now. And the old paradigm is going to have a lot of problem with this, quite frankly. There's a quote from, you know, Boyazzi's book that says, from Machiavelli, back in 1515, literally a strategist on how systems change happen, is that the current systems are not designed for new systems to be born out of them. The current systems are actually designed to keep themselves safe. And so for the people who are here to create something new, they're literally going to be operating in an entirely different paradigm. And this different paradigm, well, you know, when we look at the founder of Oracle, he says, when you're innovating something new, there's two ways that people can look at you. They look at you as completely batshit crazy. And then the other side of it is you are innovating and creating something that you've never done before. And that's exactly what we're we're going to be able to be sitting, and there's going to be people who are creating things that people are going to like, you are crazy. And then the other people are like, thank God, this is exactly what's needed. You are literally modeling a new type of leadership. You are showing how we can create regenerative systems and not just extractive systems. And what happens in the physiology when people have role models of what this new type of leadership looks like, feels like, you know, everything that they create, what happens in the body is that there's your mirror neurons go off, literally. And you start to want to model and role model this. So what I'm trying to say is that there's going to be a new type of leadership that we get to see in this coming age. And one of the things that we have to be really aware of is how our mind judges them and all the stories that the mind is going to have about how they're bad and how they're wrong and they're terrible and they're crazy. And you know, the emotional daggers that we throw at these people for doing something completely revolutionary. And then, of course, on the other side of it, people are like, that was amazing, right? And then they weren't part of that process of that actually happening. And so, and that's the birthing of something new. We're going to see newness happen, and we need it right now. We're at a tipping point in the positive or the negative, and we all have our own part and our frequency and our consciousness and our behaviors and our thoughts and our attitudes. And the way that we show up in the world literally creates an attractor field on whether we create positive change or negative change. So my biggest encouragement to your audience is use those opportunities to show within yourself, where are you being negative? What are you judging? What are you trying to fix or change? And you can either connect to a vision that's greater than yourself that creates that change process, or you're welcome to, for life to show you the way, and it's all good.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love this conversation so much. I want it to last a little longer, but unfortunately, I'm running out of time. But I'd love to extend the invitation to attend the AI Exchange networking event. I think just meeting a few people, see how the world behave a little bit here. It's a global audience, so you'll have fun meeting a few people. And I think featuring you on one of our networking event, like for 15-minute discussion with the team, that would be great too. They'll get a lot of benefit out of that. So then you'll build some connections. I have a few more short questions for you. We'll have some fun with those. I'm asking for a maybe one or two word answer, and then we'll move on. Okay. So
yes, and
fulfillment or achievement. Yes.
Yes, and
scaling or deepening. Design on purpose.
It's got to be yes execution. And, otherwise we're in extreme thinking.
Yes and?
Radical candor.
It can psychological be yes safety or radical well. Candor. Yes and? Legacy or liquidity.
Have to understand when you say things like that, it's one is about me and one is greater than myself. And one of the things that makes the scaling science unique is the last step of the scaling science is you have to create something that lives beyond you. Otherwise, it's not scalable. So it has to be, I mean, legacy, because legacy can create liquidity.
Would that be legacy then?
But I'm coming from a field of thought called dialectical behavioral therapy, which looks at everything from the yes and. So when you offer an or question, it literally invites in extreme thinking and erratic behavior. So that's why my question and my answer for each one of those, Robin, is yes and. We can have liquidity and we can have legacy. Yeah.
No, that's fine. Yes, and is okay.
Yeah,
I had
so
fun.
For people
Thank
who
so
identify as cultural
really
catalysts, you want to learn the science
Any
behind,
last comments?
You know, the cultural catalyst system. You want to look at yourself as a cultural catalyst 10 to 15 years in the future and actually set a moonshot goal while going through a transformational process. We actually have a weekly masterclass at culturalcontribution.com that we'd absolutely love to have people who are interested and want to learn more and experience that.
So, yeah. And if somebody needs to get a hold of Jacqueline Orent, please reach out to me. She's connected to me now on LinkedIn. I'll be happy to do an introduction and facilitate a conversation. I really appreciate it. Also, I want to thank the audience for joining me today on the recording of this particular episode. Thanks for being part of the conversation. Thanks for listening in. If you come in on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you come in on our podcast channels, thanks for listening in. And also for the audience, I summarize these conversations in a short blog post that I put on robinayoub.blog, which summarizes all these conversations. You know, for those people who don't want to listen for a 1 hour conversation, but they still want to get like the Coles Note version of it or the Cliff Note version of it, they can get that off of the blog post. So if you're not subscribed to it, maybe you want to subscribe to it. You're not forced to subscribe to it, but if you want to, you're welcome to. And I look forward to seeing you at the next episode. From the audience and myself, I want to thank our guest of honor today, Jacqueline Orent. Right. This podcast channel is yours. Anytime you feel coming back and update us on what's going on in your world.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate that. And the listeners will have fun with it as well. Thanks so much again. And I'll see you guys at the next episode. Thanks so much.